Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
In 1926 was the height of the harbor, flat out. We exported 1.4 billion board feet of lumber out of here. To my knowledge, that record's never been touched today.
Actually, the Aberdeen Museum of History in Grays Harbor, Washington, says it was closer to 1.1 billion board feet of lumber. Either way, it's a heck of a lot of wood. Hi, I'm Jennifer Wing, and the other voice you just heard belongs to 62-year-old Tim Quigg. We met over burgers and fries at Clark's Restaurant on Highway 101 just south of Aberdeen in southwest Washington. Tim grew up here when just about anyone could get a good job that paid well.
We're guys in a plywood mill. They'd make, you know, $11 an hour back in 73 or whatever it was. It was a lot. And an engineer was making five. The jobs were union wages, had benefits, retirement. They had meal tickets, whether you're in a cannery, a fishing boat, a plywood mill, a shake and shake, everything. And with the advancing of technology and a changing economy, those industries really went away.
The nail in the coffin for the logging industry was when the federal government declared thousands of acres of forest off-limits in order to protect the spotted owl, a pint-sized bird that prefers to live in really old trees. When these protections were put in place more than 25 years ago, it was man against bird. The owl won, sort of. Its numbers are still really low, and logging communities like Grays Harbor lost even more jobs and hope.
And if you lose hope, you'll go anywhere you can to find a better day, to dream. There's an old saying, what a sailor won't do in a storm.
Last November, like many economically depressed areas across the country, Grays Harbor, a part of the state that's known for being true blue Democrat, voted for Donald Trump. It was the first time the county went Republican since 1928, back when the people here voted for Herbert Hoover. Today on Sound Effect, just one day after the presidential inauguration of Donald Trump, we're all about flipping the script, whether it's a changed political landscape or seeing someone in a different role than we're used to. These stories and more just ahead. But first, let's spend a little more time in Grays Harbor. Trump's win here came as a big surprise. In political circles, this place is talked about as if it's surrounded by a huge, blue, impenetrable wall. Well, that wall cracked. How do people feel now that this big shift is happening? And what does this vote mean for this community? For Democrats, the Trump vote is definitely injecting some focus and enthusiasm into the local party. This is the monthly meeting of the Grays Harbor Democratic Party. It's held in an old wooden building in Aberdeen, and most of the people here are the gray-haired set, and they're pumped.
I think we're at a point where we need to pull together, not only our counties, but the party. Environmentalists, trade unions, Hillary people, Bernie people. It's time to pull it together. We have a common enemy in Donald Trump.
Jeff Engels from Jefferson County is making the case for why he should be on one of the committees that will rebuild the party's platform at the state level.
We cannot allow the Republican Party to have the working class like they just did here and trick them into their side. Thank you.
Before we get into the reasons why Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton in Grays Harbor County 49-42%, here's a snapshot of how this place is struggling. The unemployment rate in Grays Harbor hovers around 8.5%. That was Seattle's unemployment rate during the height of the Great Recession. More than 60% of kids in public schools are on free and reduced lunch. More than half of the students, and you have to be really poor to get a free meal in public school. Poverty, not enough jobs, these are issues traditionally owned by Democrats. After Trump's victory, one Seattle newspaper columnist stopped short of calling the voters in Grays Harbor stupid for voting against their own interests. But did they? Vinnie Samuel is a Democrat. She came to the United States from India when she was 7. She moved to Montesano, just east of Aberdeen along the Chehalis River, after graduating from law school. Today, she's the town's mayor. For her, Trump's victory is a slap in the face.
And I think that we probably deserved it, and I think we needed it.
Vinnie says the challenges her constituents are facing remind her of a child she mentored who never did her homework, a seemingly simple task.
And she was saying how, no, she had to take care of her siblings. And I said, well, what about in the evening when your mom gets home or your dad gets home? Oh, no, my mom goes out. And so what do you do? Well, then I do the laundry, and then I lie on the thing, and then I'm too tired to do homework, and I get up, I have to make the breakfast, whatever, whatever. And she went on, and I'm sitting here, and I'm realizing, I was thinking about school breakfast, and I was thinking, no kid is able to think unless they're fed and they can sleep. And so our electorate is sort of like that. If we're not meeting their basic needs, they're not going to be thinking about the environment or different social things. We have to meet their basic needs.
The Democrat Party in this area is beholden to a left liberal agenda promulgated by Seattle liberals that does not reflect the values of the people of this area.
This guy is Jim Walsh. He's part of the change from blue to purple. He's as tall as his voice is deep. He and his wife, Jamie, are raising 5 kids. They live in an old house in the hills above downtown Aberdeen that they're slowly restoring. The home is rumored to have been built for the Boeing family 100 years ago when the planes were made of wood sourced from the forest nearby. Jim is a Republican who won his first election in November. He's now a state representative for the 19th district.
I really want to emphasize this didn't start with Trump. Starting about 4 years ago, we had 2 Republican county commissioners in this county out of a 3-person board. You know, that was several years ago now that that happened. You know, I think the people who live here are tired of the talk, and they really want economic development. They want to try something new. And since it's a place that culturally has always been conservative but traditionally voted Democrat, something new means vote for the other guys.
Down the hill from Jim is Grays Harbor Wine Cellars, a wine bar. Karen Rowe, who grew up here, runs the community gathering space with her husband, Ryan.
When we first opened the shop down here, so many people looked at us and they came in with sad eyes and said, oh gosh, well, you know, almost patting us on the head. Good luck to you, a wine shop in Aberdeen. Okay, that's a sweet thought.
That was 4 years ago. Today, business is good. A local brewery is opening up next door. Karen is a registered Democrat. She supports gay marriage. She's pro-choice.
I also, though, am for gun rights. I'm from Grays Harbor County, after all. So while we may all be Democrat, we all want our guns. So it's a fine line.
Karen usually votes for Democrats and Republicans 50-50 down her ticket. But at the top, she's voted for Republican presidents. And this last election was no different.
Well, really, the reason for voting for Trump in my world is because as a small business owner, my number one priority was the economy. We've been doing the same thing over and over again. It's not working, and it hasn't been working. We need to change it. And maybe that means that we need to put some Republicans in office. I'm excited to see the change. And you know what? It's elections. If it doesn't work out, guess what? In 4 years, we can vote again.
Not blue, not red, purple. This is what most of us are. You can't place Karen's political views neatly in a box. Hers would have to have all sorts of angles and secret drawers. Trump won, hands down, in this part of the state. Still, in her own shop, a place where people have long conversations while they sip glasses of chilled Chardonnay and port with cherry undertones, Karen doesn't talk about how she voted with her customers. She says Trump voters are shamed and bullied. One person, after finding out Karen voted for Trump, called her an enemy.
They knew how I had voted, and in fact, on election night, they were down here. They had voted for Hillary. They were physically upset. They were crying. They were not happy with the outcome. And myself and another person that had voted for Trump were down here and consoling them. And they've since brought that up time after time, calling us enemies. I've had people call us just horrible things. You don't really know what you're doing. How do you like that your president is doing certain things or that he said certain things? And if Hillary had won, I would not look at someone and say, you're now my enemy. You're not my enemy. You're a person that voted for Hillary. You have your reasons. I have my reasons. It just kind of is what it is.
Representative Jim Walsh thanks Karen and the rest of the Trump supporters in Grays Harbor. They knew exactly what they were doing when they cast their votes.
People don't vote stupidly. The people who care to vote, vote carefully. I believe in the wisdom of crowds. The voters are generally on to something. And when they vote for a candidate, they're sending a message to leadership of all sorts. And I think they did that effectively this time here.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Wing. You're listening to Sound Effect. And if you're just joining us, we are telling stories about the script being flipped. Is what we think to be true really the case? Well, when it comes to love, marriage, and family, there are scores of beliefs that we have about these human conditions, these commitments, and how they come to be. Stephanie Kuntz is a marriage and family history expert at Evergreen State College. She's the author of lots of books, including The Way We Never Were. In this book and through her research, Stephanie says most of the ideas we have about relationships and marriage are completely backwards. She talked to Sound Effect producer Kevin Kniestad, and they started with the widely held belief that traditional marriages, back in the day, relied on the man to support the family.
The traditional marriage was not a male breadwinner family. That's one of the most untraditional marriage forms in history. Through most of history, men and women had to work together. That's why they married. You know, in colonial days, the word for wife was a yoke mate, a meat help. Men didn't bring home the bacon. Women helped raise the pig, slaughter it. They're the ones who turned it into bacon and the ones who took it into market. So this idea that men are the ones who produce and women are the ones who do the nurturing is wrong. It's wrong also in terms of men. Men were once expected to be an emotional center of the home, and they did things like arrange weddings and do the kind of social kinkeeping and social secretary work that now is assigned to women. In America, for example, it wasn't until the 1920s that a tiny majority of kids grew up in homes where the woman wasn't either working right beside the man on the farm or in a small business or going out to work herself, or they weren't going out to work themselves. That family form receded in the Great Depression and World War II, roared back in the very atypical 1950s boom, and lasted for about 15 to 20 years.
There's one word I'm not hearing, when we're talking about the history of marriage, there's one word I'm not really hearing you mention, and that's love. Was that a part of it?
Well, that's the other big myth about the traditional family. The more we've researched it, the more it's absolutely clear that marriage was invented to get in-laws. It didn't have that much to do with the relationship between the husband and wife. For the upper classes, marriage was a way of signing peace treaties and making military alliances and combining fortunes. For the middle classes, too, it was the main way that you made business deals in the absence of banks. And in the Western states, up until the 18th century, usually a man was more interested in the dowry than the daughter. And even in among the working classes, you couldn't run a farm or a business without at least two people and hopefully a bunch of in-laws who you could cooperate with. So for thousands of years, marriage was not about love, and love was actually discouraged as a precursor to marriage. It was considered kind of antisocial or disobedient to fall in love before marriage. It was okay if you did afterwards, but it was certainly not essential.
So, modern day, 2017, what are some current day misconceptions that we have about love, marriage, and relationships?
I find it a lot that men and women themselves start to get panicked if they reach their 30s or early 40s without getting married. And in the past, in 1960, the average age of marriage for a woman was 20 and 22 for a man, and the spread of marriage was very rare. If you weren't married within 5 or 6 years, you probably weren't going to. But the spread of marriage is much further out now, and one of the most interesting things is that the longer you delay marriage, on average, the longer it's going to last, the less chance of divorce you're going to have. And finally, another big thing is one of the wonderful things that we've seen in marriage is the new collaboration between men and women in parenting and their interest in parenting. But that can be taken too far, too, because actually divorce rates have been falling except for one segment of the population, and that is the older population. People over 50, their divorce rates have doubled. For over 60, it's tripled. There are lots of reasons for this, but I think one of them may be that people are spending so much energy in raising their kids together that they are forgetting to cultivate their relationship not only with each other, but with other people, the adult relationships that will sustain them when their kids go off to form their own adult relationships.
I'm wondering if there was ever a point in you doing research on marriage, love, relationships, where you came across something and said to yourself, I've done that. That was me. I did that. You know, I believe that, or I felt that way at one point, or I did that in my own relationship. Was there ever a sort of an aha moment for you that was personal?
Well, for me, not so much an aha moment as an, oh, maybe I should do more of this. And that is John Gottman's research on what are the things that long-term predict divorce. One thing that he found is a common pattern is how you respond to your partner's, he calls it bid for connection. I would even call it a bid for affection. That is, you know, he looks at newlyweds, and from the very beginning, you can tell if one of them says, oh, look at that boat out there, and the other says, I'm trying to read here. That's kind of a negative response, right? But if the other person leans into that and says, oh, yeah, let me come look at that. Oh, that reminds me of. And there's this interaction. That's a really good predictor. People who have like 85% of those, I think his research shows, you know, just don't divorce. And people who have less than 60% of those just tend to divorce. So I've always had that. My husband doesn't interrupt my work lightly. You know, he's not the kind of guy who says, oh, could you find this for me? Or, you know, I'm hungry. When are you going to make me lunch? If I'm working, he respects it. But he also will sometimes be sitting in the other room and go, huh. And most of the time, even though I'm a kind of compulsive researcher, I'll prick up my ears and lift up my head and say, what? Because I know that it's something I'm going to be interested in. After I read this, I thought to myself, now how often do I do that? Well, actually, probably 15 to 20, maybe 25% of the time, I go, because I'm working. And I have made an effort to respond more. But at the same time, if he was doing that all the time to me and I kept trying to respond positively, you know, pretty soon it would be like, what is it? I need to clench teeth, you know, and that would be worse. So I drew two lessons from that. One is you do need to really pay attention to when your partner is looking for connection or looking for just attention. But the other is you better find a partner right from the beginning who's not going to overuse that.
Historian Stephanie Kuntz teaches at the Evergreen State College in Olympia. She spoke with sound effect producer Kevin Kniestad. This is Sound Effect on KNKX 88.5 FM. I'm Jennifer Wing. Today's theme is Flip the Script. This next story is about turning the tables on the traditional parent-child dynamic. Now, I think a lot of us have had these thoughts, especially as teenagers, about our parents. Who are these people? Where did they come from? And they were never young. They don't understand what it's like to want to hang out with your friends all the time. Well, sound effect producer Allie Ferguson, she got a chance, an open window, to meet her mom as she was when she was in her early 20s. It involves an old tape cassette, a road trip, and a diary.
I'm not sure what it is about this recorder, but we both seem to be talking like this.
That's my mom, Polly. She's about 26 or 27 at the time, and she discovered these tapes a few months ago while cleaning her house. They're these mini cassettes from the 90s that fit into a small black recorder.
I don't even know why I had a tape recorder, but apparently it was a toy that I had to have. And then we started using it on the road trip.
That's my mom today. It's been nearly a quarter century since she made those tapes. She's almost 50, and I'm about the same age she was in the recordings. The two of us have always been close.
Are you nervous?
Yes, because I want the microphone.
You can't hold the mic. It's like Reporter 101, don't give anyone your microphone.
Really?
But listening to these tapes, eavesdropping on my mom in her 20s is surreal. To be clear, at the time of the recordings, I was already born. My mom was already a mom. She was not some 20-something with no care in the world like me. But in these tapes, she's living the life of a young, independent woman, a side of her I wasn't old enough to see back then.
I'm driving down the road looking at the picturesque sunset. How beautiful, I say to myself. As I'm cruising down the road at 65, yes, 10 miles above the speed limit. Am I afraid?
That last voice, that's my mom's best friend, Rachel. And she's an important part of understanding my mom at that age. The two of them have known each other since middle school in Montana. And then in their early 20s, they both gave birth to daughters, Sarah and me, within 2 days of each other. When I was just a toddler, my mom and my dad and I resettled from Montana to San Diego. When I was nearly 4, my parents decided to separate. And Rachel and her daughter, Sarah, took on a big part of our lives. They came out to San Diego and moved in with my mom and me.
I think during the time I was struggling with your dad, she was feeling very lost with her husband. And I think when she actually decided to come move out here was when I got a condo that was a little bit bigger. And she was kind of like, yeah, I want to do it. So they lived with us for 5 years.
So for 5 years, it was me, my mom, Rachel, and Sarah all sharing a home in suburban San Diego. It was weird to explain to other kids and teachers, but Sarah and I never cared. We always thought of ourselves as roommates, a never-ending sleepover. My mom and Rachel, young mothers in their 20s, went from best friends to co-parents.
We took turns, and it was a lot of tag-team parenting. Hey, you're going to do homework and feed the girls, and I'm going to go out and do happy hour with my coworkers or whatever it was.
And so what was it like when you were the mom who was tasked with taking care of us for the night?
Well, I love that too. I mean, I really enjoyed being your mom and I enjoyed hanging out with you guys and it was easy to do homework with you. Well, with you were great. Sarah was a little harder to do homework with.
But both me and Sarah had our dads who we would go see. What was it like when both me and Sarah were gone?
Oh, it's kind of hard to look at you and tell you what it was like because it was like immediate, let's put the toys and the crap away and let's live like single girls living together, going out to the pool, going out at night. It was the ultimate freedom.
How did you guys handle dating with both of us at the house?
So we kind of sat down and made an agreement that, you know, we weren't going to have any dates come to the house, at least for the first few years when you guys were so young. But there was a time when Rachel had a few boyfriends and she didn't want them calling and saying who they were to you girls, because then you would be wondering who it was. So we decided everybody would be called man. So when man called, we didn't really know who the man was.
So you and Rachel created these spaces for yourself to be young women, to not necessarily always be mothers all the time. And one of those cases is you guys go to Nebraska to surprise her mom for her 50th birthday.
No? No, the party was simply a Tupperware party.
It wasn't her birthday? You just went for a Tupperware party.
Yeah, but her mom was really excited and nervous about it. And Rachel decided, because she loved her mother so much, that she really wanted to surprise her for this Tupperware party.
We are here in Trenton. I can't believe it. It's so exciting. The excitement is just building up. This town is definitely happening. Things are happening all over the place. Wait a minute. It looks like it's rolled up.
How would you describe your and Rachel's friendship? What was it like when you guys were together?
It was just silly time. It was constant silly time. When I first met her in middle school till now, we can still be just as silly. We'll still get dressed up in costumes. I mean, not nice and do silly things.
Oh, we're driving down this dirt alley and the weeds are taller than the car, but that's okay, it's a rental. Okay, lights are out on the car. Soon we will be getting our stuff together and our bags on our head.
Can you explain the bags?
Rachel had some paper bags and we pulled over once to draw on them and mine was scary. It had bloody teeth out of it. And I was thinking, that is funny to draw on scary masks to go jump a Tupperware party.
Is that something Rachel and you would do?
Definitely. We like the surprise factor. We like the, I don't know, just doing something that nobody else would ever do. And that was true of any time we were together.
Why do you think you wanted to stand out?
I don't know. Maybe because when in high school we felt like we were, you know, like not really seen.
We're trying to sneak into the garage without tripping over these rocks. Do you hear the crickets? I do.
What do you remember about the actual surprise?
I was just so nervous and we had to go through this back entrance for some reason. That's why I was tripping on things. But her mom, her expression and her, she was crying. It was so sweet that she would be so, you know, excited.
What did the rest of the crowd think?
They were just kind of staring at us. And you would think that they would think we were burglars.
Listening to this tape, getting to hear my mom in her 20s not in mom mode, makes me realize how goofy my mom has always been. She's playful and a little fearless, which I guess are necessary qualities to choose such a creative parenting situation. My mom never second-guessed her choices, even when her own family did.
I had an uncle who told me that, you know, if I was going to remain single mother, that my child would not have a very good chance in life. And that was frustrating to hear the older generation not accept my situation. And then there was also the, you know, as it became 1 year and 2 years and 5 years that we're together, me and my best friend with our daughters, there's this questioning of, you know, what are those two doing? Are they a couple? And we weren't.
So there's a lot of people questioning your judgment and judging you.
Yeah, I felt judged. And, you know, most of your childhood was in this area where it's suburbia, the parents stay together, or when they divorce, they divorce. I think people were jealous, but they were also like looking at like, that's so weird.
That's hard to deal with all of that kind of judgment from society, from people you know, your family. Why do you think you were able to push past that?
I don't know. I think it's an internal security of who I was. I mean, I was in my 20s and 30s, and we all feel insecure at some point, but I just didn't feel insecure about how I was raising you. I didn't really care what they thought. I mean, I just had no doubt. I don't know where the inner strength comes from. I don't know if it's from the ranch upbringing.
I should step in here and say, my mom grew up on a ranch in Montana with three older brothers. They learned how to drive cars, shoot guns, and help out with cattle at a very young age. And there wasn't a ton of parental supervision in rural Montana in the 70s.
Maybe being the only girl in a very masculine environment all those years, I didn't have a choice. You know, you survive or you crawl up under a hole and have rattlesnakes thrown at you. You know,
that's very literal, by the way.
Yeah, very literal. Yeah, you have to keep your doors locked on the car or a rattlesnake might be thrown at you. But they were not alive, Allie. They were always dead. It was just disgusting.
Yep, that's my mom. Always one to laugh about the fact that her brothers threw dead snakes at her as a kid. I often wish I had more of her humor, her resilience, her playfulness.
Well, I think that's great advice for you, to be more playful and not take yourself so seriously or, you know, get mired down in what you should be doing at what age. You know, it can come and it can go and you can have tragedy and you can have great stuff, but being playful is something you can create no matter what you have or don't have.
These old tapes showed me that, of how my mom managed to be so fully herself, a young independent woman, and a working mom, all at the same time. But she has always been trying to make sure I had the whole picture.
To my unborn child, The following journal is written to you in hopes that later on in life you will read it and understand what I was like at 24 years old. I know that I always wondered what my parents were like way back when. Someday, if you're anything like your dad or I, you will also want to know where we started and how we felt. I also think it is important for you to realize how human I am and not see me as just your mother, but as an individual who is constantly learning.
So when did you write that?
It was about, I don't know, a week before you were born. 4 days before you were born.
My mom gave me this faded yellow notebook this past Christmas, and it made me realize that even at 24, my mom understood a secret about parenting. There's power in flipping the script, in letting your child see you for who you really are. I think it's what makes me and my mom so close. We're both constantly learning from everything, especially each other.
That story from sound effect producer Allie Ferguson. Welcome back. It's Sound Effect on KNKX 88.5 FM. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today we're telling stories about flipping the script. And sometimes we are the script, our lives, our bodies. You could say this is the case for people who go through the process of changing their gender. When the world sees you one way, but you have to say, no, actually, this is who I am, this can be a scary thing to do. It can be dangerous, and it can be lonely. One transgender man in Spokane sees how difficult this process can be with other trans men, so he decided to help them connect with one another by going on an epic road trip. Sound effect contributor Kyle Norris has the story.
Malcolm Rene Rabot cracks open a road atlas, and he points to a map of the United States.
This marks my route of the states that I've been to so far.
This whole thing is highlighted with red magic marker to show where he's been. He's been on the road for a year and a half with his pup named Grayson.
I don't even know where to start. Okay. Chicago, South Bend, Cleveland, Pittsburgh.
And he's still going strong. Philadelphia, the only states he hasn't hit yet are Alaska and Hawaii.
Los Angeles, Seattle, Portland.
Malcolm is 28, and he lives in Spokane for now. He's a transgender man. That means he was born female and has transitioned to male. And in every town he visits, he puts out a call to other transgender men to meet up for drinks or dinner, or just to do something fun like go hiking or go rock climbing. Malcolm has met more than 1,000 transgender men so far. Now, we're going to come back to this whole road trip thing, but first you've got to understand Malcolm's story. His parents were in the Army, and Malcolm moved around a lot as a kid. During that time, he'd never heard of LGBTQ or even gender identity. Till about 10 years ago, when he was a student at the Illinois Institute of Art for College outside of Chicago. It's about the time he realized he was not happy. He was presenting as female at the time. He was dating a man, and they were on the road to marriage.
But I had all these thoughts, and I didn't understand them. And then finally, once I met somebody who was also trans, they gave me the language to understand what my thoughts meant and how I feel. And then finally, I was like, it just clicked.
Malcolm started going to support groups for transgender people to meet other folks. He met M to F, male to female people, and F to M, female to male. But the people he really connected with were those trans masculine guys.
I just remember how important it was for me in the beginning of my transition, having others around that I could talk to about everything and like express my concerns, to celebrate with, you know, all of it.
And the trans men in his life helped guide him as he transitioned socially and physically. They supported him in a way others just couldn't, including transgender women and cisgender men. That means men who are born male and identify as male. Because trans men go through some really specific things that others just don't.
Just getting the okay to be able to go on testosterone. And then having our first shot. We tend to have parties. Some of my cis friends would come too, but you could just see like how excited the other trans men were for you, as opposed to like people who may be cisgender don't understand how exciting it really is for you to be able to just like jump around with your other trans male friends over starting testosterone, having name change, gender marker change, new ID.
As he transitioned, he would post about it online. He got kind of famous. 43,000 people follow him on Instagram, where he is known as Gorilla Shrimp. Now, that's a nickname based off of some doodles he used to make of hybrid animals. It's also a hat tip to his small size. Malcolm is 5'1". He says the name means small and mighty. Malcolm didn't set out to do a road trip across the country. It just happened. People had started to reach out to him online and share their stories, and they would ask him questions. And so he developed friendships with some of these folks. He went to Massachusetts to visit a trans guy who said he didn't know any other transgender people. But Malcolm knew for a fact that another trans guy lived about half an hour away, and that guy said he didn't know any transgender people. So Malcolm put the two in touch.
I just thought it was crazy because my reality was that I knew guys and I hung out with them all the time. So learning that others didn't have that, it just clicked. Like, I need to help these guys connect with one another. So it started as one-on-ones at first. And I was just helping them get each other's contact information. And with their permission, I was posting pictures with them. And I saw that that was starting to spread visibility in the community and out of the community, actually. So people in the community were seeing it and they were commenting and saying, hey, with each new picture you post, I'm seeing how much less and less alone I am.
More and more people were reaching out, so Malcolm decided, why not keep traveling? He has done this whole thing on a shoestring budget. He'll stay with the people he meets, and they'll feed him and let him crash on the couch. He's taken a few months off here and there to save some money and stay in one place. He works as a freelance graphic designer or as a driver for Lyft and Uber. But the whole idea is to save money to go back out on the road. Transgender people face misunderstanding and judgment and fear and hate. And sometimes that comes from their own families. Malcolm's got a story about that. He had just met a trans man and his wife and says they were super nice. And then the next day, he met a young trans man who was homeless. His family had kicked him out of the house for being transgender.
He was the one living out of his truck with his dog. And I didn't have much time to meet up with him, but I told him that I had just met someone really nice the day before, and I was like, you guys should definitely link up. And I gave them their personal information and then went on my way. And then I found out that they contacted each other, and yeah, he gave him a place to live. Like, they became family, essentially, and they call each other brothers.
The formerly homeless guy even hangs out with the couple's extended family and watches football games with them.
That's my favorite story, because when he messaged me, like, a couple months later, he was like, hey man, because of you, I now have new friends, a family, and a place to live.
Malcolm is always thinking about safety. That's why he doesn't publicly post the meetup locations. He's afraid someone could do something violent if they knew a bunch of transgender people were meeting in a public place. These meetups are a chance for trans men to be respected for who they are. And for some, that might be the only time that happens in their month or in their year.
Knowing that the people around us are going to use the right pronouns. They're not going to ask us invasive questions about our genitalia. They're just not, you know, it's a safe space where we can talk about those things if we want to, you know, if we feel comfortable.
Malcolm has met trans men all over the country, on their turf, in tiny towns and in big cities. And he's realized there's a lot of variety when it comes to transitioning and gender identity. Some people go on hormones and some don't. Some have surgeries, some don't. And some change their names, some don't.
And there's no right or wrong way, which is the beauty of it, really. It's all what we personally need for ourselves to feel whole and comfortable in our skin.
Malcolm's dream is to hit all 50 states. And once he does that, he might head to Canada or even overseas to connect trans men all over the world. And on a personal note, Malcolm has been a big inspiration for me. I'm also transitioning. I was raised female, but I've always felt masculine. And I've learned that transitioning is this big jumping into the unknown, meaning you're going to make a change to be more yourself, but you don't know what you will feel like or look like or sound like. It's terrifying. It's also thrilling and incredibly vulnerable. And seeing someone like Malcolm so far down the road is a big relief because he seems happy. He seems normal. He seems engaged with the world. And it's big inspiration and evidence it'll be okay.
That story from sound effect contributor Kyle Norris.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Sound Effect on KNKX 88.5 FM. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today we're telling stories about flipping the script. And we're going to close out the show with another look at how this presidential election transformed the political narrative. But this time, we're going to do it through music. Seattle musician John Roderick is the front man for the indie rock band The Long Winters. He's a liberal guy, and you might remember his failed bid for the Seattle City Council in 2015. But in 2016, he wrote an anthem in response to the Trump campaign called Make America Great Again. It was a part of author Dave Eggers' project, 30 Days, 30 Songs, which called on musicians to write songs for a new post-election America. Most artists wrote straightforward protest songs, but John decided on a satirical take that ended up coming from a more empathetic place. He sat down with Sound Effect producer Ali Ferguson to talk about why he went a different route.
Well, I watch the news and I know what's what. I go to rock and worship and I pray. And I see the whole world falling apart. And I thank God I live in the USA.
It's a common problem, I think, for conservative politicians that they want to use rock and roll music in their campaigns. And rock and roll musicians typically do not want their music used by conservative politicians. But I tried to write a song in the voice of a Trump supporter.
Would you have been okay if you heard it at a Trump rally?
Absolutely.
And we want someone to make America great again.
I'm still hoping that it's a big hit on conservative radio, because the challenge, of course, was that I started to write it in a satirical voice, and I wanted it to not be smug, which is a complaint lobbied against the left. And right about the time that I was thinking of it, I went home to Alaska, where I grew up, for my high school reunion. And here I am in this, you know, reunion context with all these people I grew up with, and I know them intimately in the way you can only know someone you've known for decades. And they all are Trump supporters, or a lot of them are. And so they're teasing me because I'm known as the liberal agitator. And they're like, Roderick, you know, you're going to see in November how it's going to go. And I was like, I think you guys are wrong. You know, I had a pretty confident picture of how America looked, which turned out to be wrong. But as the weekend bumbled along, I like all these people. These are my high school friends. I know where they're coming from. And I noticed that they felt like they were the fun people. Mm-hmm. That liberals were nags and scolds and, you know, humorless cultural bullies. You know, rock and roll belonged to them. They were the fun Americans. And so I was inspired kind of by the spirit of their own logic and their kind of rationalization about how uncomplicated their world is. Mm-hmm. And our world is so overcomplicated. And so I started to write the song and found it not that hard to inhabit the worldview.
Well, I'm no gun nut, but I protect my family. And I'm not racist, but my heritage makes me proud. My wife's no feminist, but she knows how to treat her man. And we want someone to make America great again.
I've played this song for a lot of Trump voters, and they accept it whole cloth. Like, yep, that's exactly where I'm coming from. Who is this amazing artist, and where do I buy his record?
I'm wondering, kind of getting at the nugget of that, is there something about songwriting that allows you to feel more empathy for the person you're trying to write the song for? Is that what allowed you to kind of feel that relation to someone who's a Trump supporter?
Yeah, because it's in the chords, it's in the voice. I tried for a long time to sing it really straight with no contractions, you know, no drawl.
Not play up any sort of Southern stereotype.
No, kind of like, ham and nam and nerp.
Yeah.
Just like, this is me in my voice straight. And the lyrics and the music don't allow it. I mean, I ended up drawing, and at a certain point I had to stop fighting. You know, like so much of songwriting is just it comes down from the sky, and you go, where did that come from? And as I was trying to do what I did, which is find a song in its tone and content that would appeal to my high school friends. The rest sort of followed. I think that's why when I play that song live, the few times I have, it elicits gasps.
Because it feels so authentic.
Yeah, and it felt, and it started to feel that way to me. I could have written 40 verses.
And so how did this affect your perception of the election and then the ultimate outcome?
You know, I was so wrong about the election and about what I thought was the, you know, the constituent underlying truth of America and where we were right now, that I realized I needed to be quiet for a little bit, because I had the same instinct that everybody did, which was to weigh immediately back in and say, well, I was completely wrong, except all of the ideas that I had that led me to that wrong conclusion, those ideas are still right. And so I'm just going to just start vociferously advocating for exactly the stuff I was advocating for yesterday, except with no doubt about it. And I realized I couldn't do it. I needed to express some self-doubt. And I started to see the cracks a little bit, not in any of our major ideas, which I still believe, but in the methodology.
Implementation and sort of the activism of it?
I think in a lot of ways it's just the tone. The tone of condescending certitude. And writing this song, I don't sympathize with a single idea that I promulgate in the lyrics. But I do empathize in the sense that I can hear that. I can hear that voice. Ryder, you're not a gun nut. Sorry I called you a gun nut. I know you just think you're protecting your family. I get it. You know, the difference of opinion we have is that I think guns should be registered and you should have to take a class and get a license. You see that as an impingement upon your freedom.
Now the laws are all going so-called politically correct, where less qualified applicants get the jobs. It was traditional values what built this country. Without help from you, East Coast college snobs.
But do you think something like this song, which would be heard mostly by liberals, allows them to create some sort of empathy for that idea that I'm no gun nut, but I do want to protect my family?
Hopefully.
You would hope so?
I don't think that the way forward is that we continue to sneer at each other.
So if something like a song can create that sort of shared empathy, do you think maybe the solution is we just need more conservative songwriters?
There are plenty of conservative songwriters. It's just that they're all happening in the mainstream country world that most listeners of this program aren't dipping their toes into.
That was local musician John Roderick talking with sound effect producer Ali Ferguson. You can watch the video of John performing his song Make America Great Again at the Sound Effect Facebook page. Well, that's it for the show this week. Sound Effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad and Ali Ferguson. Special thanks this week goes out to John Kessler, John Ford, and Kyle Norris. We get web help from Dave Nagaris, production help from Parker Miles Blom. Our intern is Addie Pratt. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. We'll be back next week when we make amends.
If I looked in the mirror and I was honest, it's like, hey, you did this. You left your kids without a father. They didn't deserve this.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.